from KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Last year, contributions to the nation's biggest charities decreased dramatically, and a new report by the Chronicle of Philanthropy highlighted an 11% decline. That's the worst in the two decades since the Chronicle first began to track donations. In this Forum segment, we ask you, our listeners, are you cutting back on charitable giving because of the economy? And in fact, let me put that question out there and give you the phone number now before we talk to our guests. We'd like to hear from you and like to hear whether or not you've actually decided to cut back or have cut back just out of the exigencies of the economic times we live in. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786, and we welcome your calls, and you can call us now, or you can send an email to forum@kqed.org, or you can post a question or comment on our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and simply click on this segment. Noelle Barton joins us, Manager of Special Projects with the Chronicle of Philanthropy. She's with us from Washington, D.C. this morning, and welcome, Noelle Barton.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Glad to have you on. Also glad to have Dr. Sandra Hernandez with us, Chief Executive Officer of the San Francisco Foundation. They are a community foundation that serves five Bay Area counties, and we'll talk with Sandra Hernandez about some of the local philanthropy. Good morning, Dr. Hernandez.
Good morning, Michael. Nice to be here.
Good to have you here. And Noelle Barton, if I may, I'd like to begin with you just by really getting a sense of what this report highlights and what it tells us. As I said, 11% decrease across the board, but it's not necessarily entirely across the board. I mean, there are some organizations that are doing okay, thank you.
Yes. You know, what some economists have said is that the worst of the recession is behind us, but what our study found is that charities are still really feeling the pinch, and they're expecting 2010 to be a flat year for giving after that median decline of about 6% in giving at the biggest charities last year. So there are some bright spots, though. Some charities have done some great things, even though they've had to cut back on fundraising staff. So those are kind of some of the high points that we like to feature.
Well, what about those high points, just for the moment? What charities are doing particularly well or are doing okay despite the economy?
Well, we know that well, I'd have to see here. Well, WNET, the New York Public Television Station, is doing a new thing with making a difference in people's lives, basically, that they had to cut a quarter of their staff, but they're doing okay.
Well, I also saw that, for example, a number of the standard organizations, the bigger organizations, seem to be doing okay, and particularly okay because they're doing things differently. There's a bit of a generational divide here that I'd like to hear you talk about. Reaching out to younger generations, texting, for example, in terms of asking for money, reaching the baby boomers through the internet and through a lot of the social networks that exist, seems to be a more effective way these days of raising money.
Yes, and a lot of the bigger charities are looking to do more with online fundraising. We've seen in another study that we do that online fundraising is a big area of growth. So even though the general donations, you know, may be kind of flattening out, they're finding growth areas in online giving and using new technology to do their fundraising.
But the main thing is, across the board, things are down.
Yeah, and, you know, 2010 is probably going to be a flat year for a lot of the biggest charities, and they're only expecting like a 2 to 3% increase in 2011.
Well, on the other hand, Dr. Sandra Hernandez, things are kind of holding steady where the San Francisco Foundation is concerned.
Yeah, they are, Michael. You know, I think there's a lot of new innovation coming into the way people give and the way people get engaged civically as a volunteer and the like. But I think in general, you know, first of all, as we're saying that the highest giving month of the year, of course, is November and December, and we're just coming into giving season. And so, you know, these are projections that 2010 will be a completely flat year. And it's also true that coming out of the recession, many of our organizations that have been around 25, 35, 40 years that are doing family support. So these are, you know, organizations that are doing support support to very low-income families. We're talking about food banks. We're talking about domestic violence shelters. Organizations like that that are providing direct services in community have found during the recession that their waiting lists have grown and their demand for services have grown. And what we've seen at the foundation—
And the money has been cut off in many instances.
Well, and the money that's been cut off and that has been delayed, you know, it took us 100 days to get a state budget in California, for example. So you have children that are in, you know, child care programs that are receiving subsidies for very low-income kids. And for 3 months, those organizations have no cash flow. But I think philanthropically, if you look at the big picture, what we've seen at the foundation is continuing giving from donor advisors who have funds at the foundation with a little bit of a reallocation of those to direct need and to direct services and to safety net programs to try to address this, you know, kind of lag. The recession's over, but people are still having trouble finding jobs and people have income needs and are suddenly going to food banks that never went to food banks or are going to food programs that never went to food programs. And families that are being pulled apart because of mortgage foreclosure and so you have domestic violence issues and the like. And so I think what we've seen is a shift towards those services. Catholic Charities was one of those organizations that in this report had seen their growing their gifts grow, and so I think that's a big piece of the story is that donors who live in communities and know these organizations, many of them serve on the boards of these organizations, are directing more of their resources to direct services during this period of time.
Well, in fact, I believe San Francisco Foundation gave about $5 million to direct services to help. Pretty much as in terms of this frayed safety net,
mortgage foreclosure prevention. So real focus to try to help families figure their way out of these mortgages that are troubled mortgages, as well as really focusing on the job training programs and the summer youth programs and really trying to focus on people getting into the workforce and continuing to work there.
And what about the distress index? I keep reading about the distress index. Help us understand this.
So Michael, the distress index is really a way to, I think, unpack what we refer to and get used to, you know, kind of in a post-World War II federal poverty levels. Well, those don't really let you see what's happening in a particular neighborhood or in a particular county that's looking at everything from applications for food stamps to applications to welfare to enrollment on Medicaid programs. And so the distress index is really trying to get a much more real time, not what happened in 2008 or what your total median income is and your purchasing power broadly is, which really in the past just related to how much of your income was going to be paid for food and shelter. This is a much more rich set of indices that are in real time. These are indices that are published by legitimate public agencies on a monthly basis. And you can actually track, is this recession over really for people living in Pittsburgh or in Alameda or in Oakland or in Bayview?
Dr. Sandra Hernandez, again, is CEO of the San Francisco Foundation, and they serve the five Bay Area counties. Let me go to your calls here. I asked the question at the beginning of the program, are you cutting back on charitable donations or charitable funding, giving, because of the economy? And I want to find out what you, our listeners, have to say, and we'll begin with you, Gary from Sacramento. Good morning.
Good morning. My name's Gary. I've been doing dog rescue in Sacramento for 11 years now, and I want to point out it's not just the big groups, big charities that are suffering. It's the little ones too, because like, you know, like in our cases, when at a time when there's more and more animals having to be given up, there's fewer and fewer people making the donations to help support the rehoming of them. So,
I think by and large that's generally true, isn't it, Senator Hernandez? I mean, what he said about the smaller.
I think that's true. I think it also depends on what niche you're in.
But I hear some rescued dogs.
I can hear the dogs, there, yeah. Exactly. But also, you need a certain amount of infrastructure in an organization to be successful at appealing to philanthropic institutions and or high net worth donors or just average donors. And those are that infrastructure tends to get contracted during a recession when you have to figure out how do you make payroll. And for smaller organizations, that's very much true. And we have seen, you know, all of the animal shelters, because of mortgage foreclosure, people leave their homes, don't have the ability to take their pets with them. And so that's an example of being in a situation where it's much harder to compete for the philanthropic dollars that are out there.
Well, it has become, Noel Barton, exceedingly competitive for these these philanthropic dollars, and particularly in these difficult times. When Dr. Hernandez mentions infrastructure, often it seems to me, and I wonder if this conforms with your analysis, that's the key to success for many of these organizations, or at least dealing with the difficult times and doing better.
Yes, I would have to agree, Michael. You know, these big charities and even the small charities have to have pretty savvy organizations, pretty savvy operations to raise money, both through direct mail and online fundraising methods. And whenever there's a pinch in the budget, you know, the fundraising staff might be affected. One of the survey questions that we asked about was whether organizations had taken steps like frozen salaries or laid off employees. And we found that over a quarter of those respondents in our survey had taken some kind of move to cut back on staff or freeze hiring or cut salaries. And about half of those decisions had affected their fundraising staff. So whenever that kind of decision affects fundraising staff, it just becomes harder for an organization to raise money, you know, to do their mission, to carry out their mission.
Yeah, more and people get laid off of nonprofits, and then they become more dependent upon some of the nonprofits. I mean, that's the paradox, isn't it?
Exactly.
Let me get some more of our callers in here from Livermore. Meg, hi, join us. You're on.
Hi there, Michael. My husband and I have, since we got married, given a percentage of our income, and thankfully we're doing well in this economy, and I just went back to work, so that means we're actually giving more this year than we've given in the past. And I definitely find that the organizations that we give to, a lot of the people that we give to are coming back to us and saying, you know, a lot of our donors have dropped away, could you increase, that sort of thing. So we're going to have to make some decisions as the year, you know, as we make our plans for next year. But I would just encourage people to, you know, to give a percentage and to be really intentional about it.
I'm glad you brought that up, Megan. I'd like to hear what Sandra Hernandez has to say. As you know, Sandra, Claude Rosenberg, who is a dear friend of mine, yes, and major donor of this program for many years, along with his wife, Louise, had this tithing philanthropic project, and it made perfect sense in terms of scaling your income. And he really wanted to convert masses of people to go along with that idea, but it's been slow and glacier-like.
Well, no. I appreciate the caller making the point about giving from income, because I think it's important not to lose a big picture in this country, which is that people who are relatively not wealthy and work tend to be disproportionately generous with their giving. And there are many good examples of that. And actually, there are many philanthropic efforts that are meant to garner that. So today, for example, Asian Pacific Islanders in Philanthropy is celebrating their 20th anniversary. And they've been developing giving circles. And giving circles are not for people who are, you know, of the Gates ilk or of the, you know, we have great, very wealthy givers, and there's a big, bold plan to get them to step up and to make more contributions and commitments to contributions. But I think it's also important that many people give disproportionate to what their capabilities are to give, and there's research around that that really says, you know, actually these are people who really understand that a little bit of money that they can give can actually go a long way in helping somebody who has less than them. And these giving circles are not necessarily about extremely high wealth individuals, but are about ways people can come together as community to support organizations that are serving their community. And Claude was really a big champion of tithing and the notion that you should think about giving from your income, and very high net worth people who obviously do think about and plan about how do they give from their wealth. An important point just to note here, Michael, that I think is embedded in this study that we're talking about today, which is that our estate tax in this country is in flux. So for very high net worth individuals who are trying to think about their intergenerational transfer of assets and of their philanthropic intergenerational giving, they're working in limbo. We don't currently have an estate tax. A couple of bills have been introduced that would be retroactive estate taxing. And so there's a certain amount of uncertainty in a very high net worth individual families to try to figure out how to think about their estate in giving to their spouses and to their children and to their grandchildren. And many of these people are philanthropic and want to be able to do that planning and are really unable to plan because of
too many impediments,
too many uncertainties.
And uncertainties, yeah. I mean, the uncertainties are the impediments.
Yeah.
We're getting, apropos of that, listeners making suggestions just about how they donate and how others might want to follow suit. Here's Kate from Sonoma who says, I'm retired but always gave generously. In order to continue to do so, I have started to gift donations in names of friends and family. I've asked that they do the same for me. Thus, I figure I have generated over $1,000 of donations this year so far. I highly recommend this method to all. Most adults I know do not need any more stuff, she adds. And let's go to more calls here. And we welcome from Denville, New Jersey. Bob, you're on. Hi.
Hi, Michael. How are you?
Okay, thank you.
I'm on the board of a nonprofit agency that specializes in preschool education for children of families who meet the federal poverty levels. Mm-hmm. I also live in one of the top 10 wealthiest counties in the United States. The United Way here has just sent around a letter saying they're going to cut back by 20% on their giving. They have not kept pace with their certainly have not kept pace with the needs, nor have they kept pace with their former fundraising ability. They just apparently have not adapted to the new culture, the new structures, and so forth. So I'm very, very skeptical of these numbers that say these organizations are doing well. You know, I think that people are reluctant to give to an organization that says, hey, we're desperate.
Well, the United Way, as you may recall, Bob, and a certain my guest for the half-hour segment here recall, had gone through kind of a pretty dreadful scandal a number of years ago with its,
yeah, but
its CEO. No, but I recognize that's not what you're addressing here. And I'd like to hear Noel Barton actually opine on or bring us some more light on this whole subject of the United Way.
Well, United Way actually, as a system-wide, ranked number one on our list of the biggest fundraising charities in the country with almost $4 billion in money raised in 2009. But that's not to say that the individual United Ways all function the same way or have fundraising operations that do what they need to do for their community. There's, you know, like in any big system, there's going to be branches that function better and some don't function quite as well. And so maybe what this caller Bob is talking about is maybe one of those groups that is having more trouble raising money and supporting the charities in the community that are in need.
Bob, you want to respond?
Yes, I do, because I keep track of this, and I have friends who are very involved in food banking, for example, who tell me that in the Southwest Florida area, which is one of the areas that's gotten the hardest hit by the recession and the foreclosure, United Way contributions are up. They have kept pace. And in other areas where some numbers are available, Massachusetts, for example, their United Way giving is up. And my point being that this county I'm in is consistently in the top five wealthiest counties in the United States, and yet somehow or another we're not reaching the people with money to contribute, and United Way doesn't seem to be up to the task.
Well, we hear what you're saying, and we thank you for the call. And, you know, it kind of boils down, Sandra Hernandez, to some organizations just doing a better job and being more effective at raising money. I mean, you've right now, San Francisco Foundation, under your leadership, has assets of about $1 billion. And it says something about the generosity of people out here, but also about your organization and leadership.
Well, thank you, Michael. I mean, I do think that a big piece of community foundations and the role that they play is to be able to bring donors together and also to be able to accept estate gifts and the like that allow you to invest and steward those resources so that you don't have very volatile giving over periods of time and that you're not sort of worried about what happened most recently in the stock market or whether we had a lot of IPOs or fewer IPOs. And I think it's really important to look at the ability to aggregate those resources, to steward them for a long period of time, and to assure a certain amount of giving into the community. And, you know, when we have a small private foundation locally, for example, that lost assets in the Madoff problem. And so I think, you know, there's a lot of pieces to making sure that you sustain an infrastructure of nonprofits. And the recession has also had nonprofits come together and think about how did the food banks work together, something that didn't happen pre-recession, for example, and how how do the domestic violence shelters think about sharing backroom operations so that they're stronger going forward? And many of our corporations are helping support those efforts. And so I think corporate giving has changed. Mm. And that's not necessarily bad. It may not be coming through the old ways, but it has created new ways.
And, some of that is generational, too.
Some of that is generational. Yeah. And, you know, we've got, you know, very large donors here locally who've contributed to rebuilding our children's hospital at UCSF. And so I think it's important to look at all of the pieces of it, and the infrastructure of nonprofits working closer together during this recession, I think, in the long run, strengthens the ability of those organizations to serve the most needy.
Can you build those partnerships as you've always wanted to do, especially when things have become so competitive for fewer dollars?
I think it's an incentive for people to say, how do we share backroom operations? Does everybody need to have a CFO and an HR director and do payroll? And if you're doing like services, can we get big organizations to say, we'll provide those services for organizations that are doing a unique reach in a particular community? And what community foundations allow you to do is bring those people together and have the heads of the food banks in the five Bay Area counties actually talk about how do we think about being more efficient with the philanthropic dollars we get. And that's a good thing.
Well, you mentioned food banks. Here's an anonymous caller who posted on our website, I've cut back on charitable giving except to my local food bank, where I have increased my donations. And the reason I like them is that they are helping my own neighbors who never thought they would need this kind of help. Another listener posted on the website, I'm on the board of BCE, Burlingame Community for Education Foundation, a nonprofit organization that raises money for six Burlingame public schools. We are very fortunate to say that we are able to raise more last year than previous years. We believe this is because school districts are cutting their budgets and parents feel that donating directly to our foundation will positively impact their children's education right away. Let's go to more of your calls, and we'll bring in a caller from Nashville, Tennessee. Christine, welcome.
Hi, thank you. I think that donations would be up considerably if people could have more faith in not-for-profit. I have been an administrator in the not-for-profit sector for approximately 40 years now, and I have been appalled at the amount of fraud that occurs. And these things become public, and then people lose faith. And I think I think that the not-for-profit structure contributes to this problem tremendously. I think that often there is too close of a relationship between executive directors and boards of directors, and that allows a lot of fraud to occur, but also a lot of not-for-profits run under the radar because they are small, and even if you identify a problem and report it, for example, to the IRS, the amount of money involved is so small that they are not willing to address the problem because they want to only address larger amounts of money that are going to be more impactful if they find a fraud of several million dollars versus a not-for-profit that maybe has a budget of $800,000.
I'm wondering, Christine, excuse me, just whether or not the Chronicle of Philanthropy and the special study they did came up with some of the reasons, perhaps other than economic, that things have flattened as far as giving. Noel Barton, were you able to determine whether people felt there was, you know, rife fraud or waste or those reasons behind perhaps decline?
We didn't actually ask any questions about that, but I think that's always kind of an underlying issue. It's one of the reasons I think people tend to give to the big-name charities that they've heard about in the news rather than smaller charities. They think maybe that the larger charities have been, you know, run like sophisticated operations and have their checks and balances in place. But the vast majority of charities are small charities, and they're run by lay people in communities that want to do good. And just like Christine said, sometimes they get off course, and that's just kind of like any industry, but there's certainly a fair amount of it in the charitable sector.
And I thank Christine for the call. Sandra Hernandez, you want to add something?
I was just going to say, Michael, you know, in California, we passed a Nonprofit Integrity Act, and it really had a Sarbanes-Oxley for the nonprofit sector in mind, for organizations of a certain size. And it really did push the sector to make sure that an audit committee was different than a finance committee, and that if you have, you know, fundraising of a certain amount, that that's reported on your 990s. And there are a lot of entities now working at looking at more transparency into 990s and really to try to improve overall transparency, accountability, and stewardship. And I think California really did benefit from that. Not all other states have done that, but I think coming out of the, you know, the Sarbanes-Oxley arena and, you know, the challenges with our banks and, you know, there are a lot of industries where you could look and say a lot of improvement was needed around checks and balances, accountability, what you write in your financial statements, who reads financial statements. And in community foundations in the larger cities, we have people who sit and actually read 990s and read the financial statements and read the audits of these organizations to make sure that donors who are contributing to organizations that are well-governed and well-run and well-administered.
And we'll take another call, and that's you, Kathleen. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael and Noel. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. I come from a maybe a different perspective. I am a permanently disabled, fairly young woman who, prior to my being disabled, I've always been a service, nonprofit, philanthropic individual. However, the reason for my calling in is that I live under the poverty wage, and yet in everyday life, I repeatedly give somebody who's on the street who is homeless, who I don't, you know, if they ask for change, if I have change in my pocket, I will give it to them and say, I once was homeless, I fell through the cracks, and I'm not now, so here, you know, pay it forward. And in the same vein, in any way, shape, or form that I can be of a kind, caring, and that I can give back. If I have foods that I've gotten from the food bank that I don't use, I give it back to them immediately. And I'm not tooting my horn so much as saying some of what you're speaking of, I understand intellectually, but it's kind of over the head of people who are just barely even making ends meet, and that it has this particular form of what I would call the karmic bank account has never let me down. It has come back tenfold, hundredfold, and that's just my comment, and I'd like your opinion.
Appreciate your comment, and we've got seconds left. Want to say something on this line, Sandra Hernandez?
Well, that's really the essence of philanthropy is empathy in a sense that one's conditions could always be worse. And whether you're a very successful, high net worth individual who's made a lot of wealth in a company or a new company, or whether you're somebody like you, it is what distinguishes this country from many other places in the world and a lot of what we try to promote globally and in our global health work and the like. And so I appreciate very much your comment. Thank
well,
you.
And appreciate both of you being with us. Sandra Hernandez, again, is Chief Executive Officer of the San Francisco Foundation. Noel Barton, Manager of Special Projects with the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Can we get your report online, Noel?
Yes, we're on philanthropy.com.
And thank you for this good segment on philanthropy. Thank you, our listeners. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. Thanks to Senior Editor Dan Zoll, our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.